Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. Welcome to Route 51, regional talk radio for North Central Wisconsin. I'm Glenn Moberg, and today we celebrate spring, and specifically the spring migration of waterfowl, raptors, and songbirds, all making their way north and settling in our forests, prairies, and backyards for the summer. If you look out your window at your backyard feeder, you might see myrtle warblers, rose-breasted grosbeaks, indigo buntings, and orioles, just four of the species that have arrived in north central Wisconsin just within the past few days. Head to the shoreline of your favorite river or lake, and you'll see Canada geese already tending to broods of small, fluffy yellow goslings, while loons sit on soon-to-hatch eggs, and ducks, from mergansers to mallards, set up housekeeping. We've got a special guest for the next hour, Stan Tequila, a noted naturalist, wildlife photographer, syndicated columnist, and the author of over 100 field guides and nature books, including Birds of Wisconsin, Wildflowers of Wisconsin, and Fascinating Loons. Also more than a dozen CDs with recorded bird songs and wildlife identification guides. Now, if you'd like to find out more about Stan, you can check out his website, naturesmart.com. But for the next hour, he's going to share some tips for bird watchers, some bird lore, and if you're an amateur photographer, those of you who have questions about how to take those elusive wildlife photos up close and in focus, well, you want to give us a call. Our lines are open right now at 261-6371. That's 261-6371, or toll free at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Stan Tequila, welcome to Route 51.
Well, thank you.
And right now, you know, I've got my copy of Wildflowers of Wisconsin.
Oh, good.
And I'm thumbing through it, and one of the interesting things about this particular guide is that it's color-coded.
Yeah.
Go on.
Yeah, I was going to kind of elaborate on that. My field guides are all set up for what I kind of call the average person. I think of somebody like, my mother, for example, or something like that, who's got a strong interest in the outdoors, but really has no formal training in it. And so I try to set up the field guides so that they are user-friendly, you know, not to, you know, use an overused term, but so that it's something you could pick up. And I have something what I call the 10-second rule. If you can't pick up the book and figure it out in 10 seconds, then I've done something wrong.
It is really a simple book. First of all, it's small, so you can fit it in a pocket easily.
That's the main thing. You can take it with you into the field, which is what you need to do when you're identifying flowers or trees or reptiles, amphibians, or birds, or anything like that.
And then the color coding, yep. You've got tabs right on the top, so if you can just thumb through, and it goes from brown to green to orange to pink to purple to red and white. So if you're hiking and you see an unfamiliar plant, you can just thumb right to the section of the book with that color of flower on it,
yeah,
instead of wading through some kind of an organizational scheme based on scientific categorization of families and species.
Right.
So this is a great idea. Was that yours?
Yeah, the color coding is an idea I came up with to help kind of make it simpler. And it's the first thing that people notice when they look at something like that. They don't notice that it's one of the delphiniums. They don't notice that it's one of the buttercups. They notice that it's a yellow flower. And so that's kind of the easiest way to do it. And it's, you know, fairly successful. There have been other field guides that have used color. I think what I've done is made it just a little easier because within each color section, it goes by size. So the smallest yellow flowers first and then the big yellow flowers last. And then I also grouped up the flowers so that the simple flowers, the ones that just have little petals going around them, are grouped together. And then the tubed flowers are grouped together. So, you know, it's not hard to really narrow down your choices. If you find a simple yellow flower at this time of year, you look in that section and you're going to find that flower.
And you do the same thing for your bird guides.
Yeah, same thing there, using the prominent color on the bird. Obviously, the male cardinal would be in the red section, but the female is kind of brown, so she's in the brown section. I cross-reference both of those back and forth to each other so you don't have any problems, you know. You know, indigo bunting would be another good example of that. The male indigo bunting, bright blue. Female, she's brown. And so you wouldn't even know that those two birds are related to each other, let alone the same species, because they look so completely different. And that's why it can be very confusing. You know, traditional field guides are set up in phylogenetic order or the way in which they're related to each other.
Right.
And frankly, you have to have a degree in biology to figure that stuff out. So I've never understood why people put up with field guides that were so complicated in the first place that it really pushed you away from them. And only the people who really stuck to it and, you know, kind of worked at it were the ones who were able to use those types of field guides. And I was just trying to make a field guide for, you know, the trees and the reptiles and amphibians and all the different things that we see that would be, used by somebody other than a biologist.
Well, it's definitely user-friendly. And man, you've got quite a career going for you. You've got more than 100 of these wildlife guides and books. You've got dozens of bird identification CDs. You're a syndicated columnist. You're a lecturer. What got you interested in being a naturalist? Is that something that started very early in your life?
Well, you know, as far as I can remember back, it is all I've ever wanted to do. I just had this thing where I really wanted to write nature books from a very young age. Now, I grew up on the west side of Chicago, and that's not something that you would tell just any old person. You tell me you want to write nature books, and you get beat up, you know.
Were you in Chicago itself or in one of the suburbs?
I was right next to O'Hare Airport there.
In Rosemont?
Des Plaines.
Des Plaines. Yeah. The Des Plaines River goes through there. But
I've spent so much time on the Des Plaines River, it's not even funny. I mean, it's just,
I don't know if that's something that we should be bragging about
or
not.
No, it's not. But that's where my haven was. That's where my sanctuary was. That's where I would run away to.
Well Stan, I haven't, we haven't talked in any detail, but I grew up in Palatine, Illinois.
Oh, is that right?
and I spent a lot of time on Salt Creek, which,
sure,
I think was almost as polluted as the Des Plaines River.
Yes. Yeah.
So, absolutely. How did you develop an interest in being a naturalist growing up in an urban environment?
Well, you know, that's the thing. When you're, it's almost like being hardwired that way. This is all I've ever had any interest in doing. It's all I've ever really wanted to do, and I've just kind of followed it throughout my whole life. I never did believe that I could actually do this. Now, even as a young boy, I'm 49 years old, and so. Even as a young child, I really wanted to write nature books. And so I literally started taking a three-ring binder and putting paper in there, then handwriting in my text, and then I'd do my little drawings. Later on, when I became a teenager, I started taking pictures, and I would take those pictures and I would glue them into there. And I just always had this obsession with writing field guides and about nature and exploring nature.
So it started in your own backyard. Was your dad a naturalist?
My dad was very much so. I credit him to be the one who kind of really got me interested in the whole thing. He would come home. He'd go out early on Sunday mornings and go out to the local forest preserve and come back with a variety of edible mushroom that he would cook up for the family. And I just was so impressed with that. I just thought, holy mackerel, that is just so cool that you could go out in the woods and find an edible mushroom.
Well,
and
he must have known what he was doing because you're still here.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And that was really something. And he had this great love for nature. One of my fondest memories of my dad is him laying on his belly with his Leica camera, taking pictures of wildflowers out in Yellowstone on a family vacation. And this was a big, strapping, hulking man who didn't, you know, had no problems laying right down there next to the roadside and taking pictures of tiny little flowers because he thought they were absolutely beautiful. So, my mom's a very active environmental activist and political activist, and I kind of come by all this fairly honestly, really. It's just something that I've always had and always done. And
so you live in Minnesota now?
Yes, I'm southwest of the Twin Cities in a small town. I moved here in 1977 and have been here ever since. So.
And you work at something called the Eden Prairie Outdoor Center. What is that?
I'm the director of a small city-owned nature center in Eden Prairie, Minnesota. So it's a great job in that we offer environmental education programs. I lead a lot of birding trips and a lot of wildflower walks and things like that through the nature center. So the locals sign up for programs and they go out on different things with us. And it's just a great little facility.
What's a typical day like for Stan Tequila? What were you doing this morning?
I got up at 5 this morning. Drove about an hour to go to a local state forest where I literally crawled on my hands and knees through the forest to get to a ruffed grouse who was drumming on a log and sat and photographed him for about 3 hours. And then, which was fantastic because, you know, that's really where the learning comes in, spending that kind of quality time with an individual species. You learn a lot. I mean, I sat there and timed the intervals in between the time that he would drum, how long you took a break for, all the different things. And you really, kind of amass a lot of knowledge when you spend that kind of time,
right.
with a species. And from there, I headed back to the Nature Center where I had to give a little tour to a group of people. And so I brought out a lot of our animals that we have at the Nature Center. I gave them a tour and then came on home and got in the home office, and here we are.
So
that's a typical day. It really is.
Well, you take all the photos for your wildlife guides. Is that correct?
Yeah, not all, but nearly all, yes.
And you also record all of the sound for those nature CDs.
Yeah, and to me, being in the field, taking those pictures, making the recordings makes all the difference in my knowledge of the birds or the animals or whatever it may be. That firsthand experience, that kind of one-on-one, is where the rubber hits the road, and that's where I think it makes me different than I think anybody else who's more of an armchair naturalist and maybe doesn't experience them. I travel a lot. I had a heck of a past 3-4 months, and in February I was in Yellowstone photographing wolves, so that was absolutely spectacular. In March I was down in Nebraska for the annual migration of sandhill cranes. I went to San Diego. Went to Mexico for 10 days photographing birds down along the Pacific coast of Mexico last month, and this is just how it goes.
Man, you've got a great lifestyle.
Yeah, I just keep going and going, and I enjoy the heck out of it.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm going to take a short break, and when we come back, I'm going to ask you about outdoor photography. Maybe we can get some photography tips for the amateur photographers that are listening. And if any of you would like to find out how to capture those elusive wildlife shots up close and in focus, this is the guy to talk to, Stan Tequila. Our lines are open for you right now at 261-6371, 261-6371, or 1-800-780-9742, 780-9742. Or if you've got any questions about wildlife, wildflowers, bird lore, the kinds of birds that you might be seeing at your backyard feeder right now that you can't identify, this is the guy, Stan Tequila, 261-6371, 1-800-780-9742. We'll be back after this short break.
Contributors to Wisconsin Public Radio include attorney Paul A. Sturgill, serving the legal needs of the elderly and their families throughout Wisconsin and Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Toll-free information is at 888-613-0600.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from UMR, providing Employee Benefits Administration, Integrated Health Management, and Pharmacy Benefits Administration for self-funded employers throughout the U.S. More about UMR at umr.com.
I'm Glenn Mobrig. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. Our guest today, Stan Tequila, the author of Birds of Wisconsin, Wildflowers of Wisconsin, over 100 wildlife guides. He's a naturalist and a wildlife photographer, and we're taking your phone calls about bird watching and wildlife photography tips. If you've ever wondered how to get that elusive shot, this is a guy to talk to. Our number, 261-6371, or if you're outside the Wausau area, 1-800-780-9742. Let's go to the phones right now. We have John in Park Falls. John, you're on Route 51.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is pretty simple. I get a lot of birds at my feeder, my bird feeder in the backyard, and I don't want to page through these 1,000-page books like I have. I have 2 or 3 of them. Maybe I just need to pick up a copy of your book, and it'll be just unique to my area. I live in actually central Wisconsin in Wisconsin Rapids, and I'm struggling with finding the birds that are at my feeder. By having to page through so many different kinds of books, and I'm wondering what you recommend.
Well, there's over 900 species of birds in North America. Wisconsin has about, on record, about 440 or so, somewhere right around 430 ever. I mean, that's a list. What I've done is captured just the birds of Wisconsin in a field guide, so that when you're looking through there, you're not looking at birds that only occur in Texas or California or something like that. So really, I think that's the strength of these books, is that they're broken down by the state, and you're not going to be confused or fooled by a bird that just won't be seen in your backyard.
Well, the fact that they're color coded has got to help too.
Yeah, it helps tremendously too, especially your backyard birds, which are so colorful, and you're able to really zoom right in on them too. So I can only guarantee you that you will be able to identify your birds in your backyard.
John, what are you looking at right now? What have you seen the last couple of days that maybe you couldn't identify?
Well, it's a yellow bird, one that comes to the feeder frequently. It looks like a finch, but I don't think that's the proper name for it. It's only about the same size, I should say, but it's almost all yellow with maybe a little bit of black, but almost an entirely yellow bird.
Oh, it sounds these like
are, yeah, these
goldfinch?
Are the male goldfinch. Yeah, the American goldfinch is a you won't find it under the listing of finch, by the way. You find it under a listing of goldfinch, and it is the males are bright yellow with black foreheads and black wings. The females are kind of an olive green, if you will. They don't, and what, you know, they look like that they just showed up at your feeder when, in fact, they've probably been there for quite a while. The males in the wintertime molt to a color of olive green also, so they look just like the females. And starting in about January, February, they start changing colors, and they add in these colorful feathers, and then they change colors. So right now is when you start to notice them, when they get a full coat of these yellow, these bright yellow flowers. They also call us the canary bird for obvious reasons, too.
Oh wow! Well, that's terrific.
You won't have any problems finding your birds in the Birds of Wisconsin book. You just look under the yellow section, and you'll see it.
And do you recommend just going online to purchase one, or do I go to the nearest bookstore? Or?
Just about any of your local bookstores will have it, and any of the online stores also will carry it too.
And what's your website again?
NatureSmart.com.
NatureSmart.com. John, thanks so much for the phone call.
Thank you.
261-6371, 261-6371, or 1-800-780-9742. If you want to talk to wildlife photographer and nature book author, Stan Tequila. Stan, are you an old-fashioned analog photographer using film and a single-lens reflex camera, or are you digital?
Well, I started out that way. Started out with just a film, you know, a 35-millimeter camera. And then in 1999, 2000, switched over to digital. I was one of the few and first professional photographers who went to the digital. I struggled with film. It is not my medium. A lot of people love it. I was not a big fan of film. And so when the digital came along, I looked at it and said, that's for me. And I literally ran towards it and said, I want that digital thing. And I can remember being on trips in Arizona photographing birds thinking, if I just had digital, I could do this, I could do that.
You know, I've got a single-lens reflex analog camera, Pentax K1000.
Oh, I still have one of those.
Well, you do waste a lot of film. You end up taking, eight or nine shots in order to get one good one.
And you're also, you know, the digital takes a lot of the guesswork out of the exposures. And in addition to that, the range of colors and the range of detail that the digital has really has far surpassed what film has. I can take pictures now that I've only dreamed of before with film, and it's really an amazing difference. I mean, huge difference. I can't even begin to say how big a difference it is because it's that big of a difference.
Well, if you've got, I imagine you've got a top-of-the-line digital camera.
I have the best, yes.
And if you have a digital camera, how do you get some of the shots that you've got, like of hummingbirds? You've got shots of them absolutely in focus, absolutely still, hovering over plants.
Well, now the hummingbirds is a highly specialized photography. I use anywhere from 4 to 6 flashes all at the same time. So I'll set up 2 flashes just to flash on the background, 2 flashes just to go on the bird itself, and then I'll use 2 more to fill in wherever I need it. So, I mean, it's a minimum of 4 and up to 6 flashes that I use just to do that. Then I dial it down, and I dial the flashes down so that they only put out about 1/64th power, meaning the burst of light that they give is very, very, very short duration. And
wow.
Then I go to I switch the camera over to manual and shoot at about 250th of a second, which doesn't matter. And then here's the big key. You ready for this? Here's the big, none of it'll work unless you do all of this in the shade. It cannot be out in the sun. You have to literally have a top over you to shade the sunlight, otherwise it won't work.
Because the sun would
bring in too much light.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. And it would overexpose it, and it would allow your lens to stay, or your aperture to stay open longer, and you would get that blurring of the wings.
Well, you've got some tremendous shots of bats at night, too. Is it a similar technique?
The bats at night are taken very similar, 4 flashes. And the only difference is I use an infrared trigger. So this trigger I set up so that when the bat goes through the beam, it triggers the camera and all the flashes go off and it takes this picture.
Wow.
So same, very same, similar type of thing, but Again, it's in the dark, and obviously the bats are taken at night. And I love that type of photography. A lot of that I did in the desert of Arizona in August. It's 95 degrees at, 1 o'clock in the morning. It's, I love that type of the environment of, of extremes. There you are in the desert. You got these bats flying around. It's warm. It's just, I just love that.
What kind of lenses do you use? They must be big honking lenses.
Well, I have a variety of lenses, of course, but the largest lens I have is a 600 millimeter f/4. So, and that may not sound like much, but that lens is as long as my arm outstretched. It's about 10 inches in diameter, so about the size of a dinner plate. It weighs 12 pounds.
So needless to say, you're using a tripod.
Yes, yeah. Well, yeah, just the lens alone weighs 12 pounds. And so it's quite, big and heavy, and it costs about close to $9,000 just for the lens. So it's pretty spendy stuff. It really is.
Wow.
That's on the big end. On the little end, I use, everything from a macro all the way to a 100 to 400 zoom to a 500 f/4. So I have a variety of different lenses for a variety of situations. But for those birds, people don't realize how small these birds are. For example, the other day...
Stan, you're going to have to hold that thought. We've got a break for news. But when we come back, I'm going to ask you to give some tips for photographers, would-be wildlife photographers, who don't have a professional budget. Maybe they can only afford, say, $1,000 or less for a good camera.
Sure.
Stan Tequila, wildlife photographer, the author of over 100 nature guides, including Birds of Wisconsin and Wildflowers of Wisconsin. We're taking your phone calls, 261-6371, 1-800-780-9742. Back after this.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Rutabaga, the paddle sport shop, offering a large selection of kayaks designed specifically for fishing and other outdoor activities. Rutabaga, 220 West Broadway in Monona, or on the web at rutabaga.com.
We are back on Route 51, regional talk radio for North Central Wisconsin on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Glenn Moberg. Our guest today, naturalist Stan Tequila, the author of over 100 wildlife field guides and books about nature, including Birds of Wisconsin, Wildflowers of Wisconsin, and Mammals of Wisconsin. And Stan, when we left off, we were talking about photography.
Yep.
And I was about to ask you, how much, if you're an amateur photographer, you still want to capture some quality of shots of wildlife out in the field, how much do you have to spend on a digital camera?
Well, fortunately, the digital cameras have come down in price, and their quality has gone up. And it's really not a matter of how many megapixels a camera has. In fact, you can keep the extra megapixels. I'm not interested. What is really important is the type of sensor is in that camera. And the better the sensor, the better the image. So the sensor would be the equivalent to the film. If you put crummy film in, you get grainy and it doesn't look good.
Right.
If you put in good film, then you get a smoother look to it. And so that sensor is very, very important.
What do you look for in a sensor?
Well, the sensor, the size of the pixels on the sensor. So sometimes they've got very, very large pixels on each sensor, and that means that they're not very, tight together. And so when they're not tight together, you get that grainy look to it.
Okay.
Whereas the newer sensors that are kind of a good quality sensor, the pixels are much smaller, and they're packed together nice and tight, and they give a smooth, grainy, or less grainy look to the image.
Well, let's say $1,000 or under. Are there any cameras you could recommend?
Yeah, the beginning, what they call the consumer grade digital SLRs are a way to go.
Now, you can go ahead and give me some brand names.
Well, I don't know much of the about the name brands. I shoot Canon only because I've always shot Canon. For no other reason than I've been doing it for 25 years that way. I do know that the Nikon lately has come up with a couple of really nice cameras that I've been very impressed with.
Mm-hmm.
They're running about $1,500, In particular, that D300 that the Nikon has. It's a very, very impressive camera. It has more bells and whistles than I know even know what to do with, so it's a very impressive camera. But the Canon, the XTIs are also very good cameras, too. You really need a decent lens. That is more important than just about anything. The lens quality is going to have a direct impact on whether or not your image is actually sharp or not. And you may think your image is sharp, but when you compare it to one that really is sharp, you'll actually see the differences there. I remember...
What lenses do you recommend?
Well, I would always go with the name brand lenses and try to avoid the off-name brand ones. Now, they're going to cost more money, but there's a reason for that. They usually have... In particular, with the Canon lenses, the image stabilization that is available on most of their lenses mm-hmm. is worth every penny you pay for.
Okay.
The image stabilization it blows me away. It's a technology that they're on their second generation technology of image stabilization, and it is nothing short of amazing. It'll improve your images double, by going with an image stabilized lens. So that's a big tip right there. It really is. You're gonna end up spending more for it. But it's really worth it. Nikon has the vibration reduction. They call it VR. Same thing. Well worth every penny.
You're listening to Route 51. Our guest is Stan Tequila, wildlife photographer. Boy, we had a caller from Ogama who we just lost. Kerry, if you want to call us back, we'll try to get to your phone calls. And what I do want to talk about right now, let me give the numbers out, 261-6371 or 1-800-780-9742. Some of the birds that are just arriving in the area right now, Stan, just yesterday I saw my first oriole of the year. Last week I saw an indigo bunting and what used to be called a myrtle warbler or a yellow-rumped warbler. What other birds are returning right now?
Well, the hummingbirds are also returning right now. This is kind of and the rose-breasted grosbeaks are the other ones that are coming in right now. These are the true neotropical migrants. These are the birds that go all the way down to the tropics for the wintertime. They spend their winters down there, and then they come back. And they come back on a regular set time schedule. So if we have an early spring, it doesn't matter to them because they don't know that. They're thousands of miles away. They come back according to the amount of daylight available during the day. This is called the photo period. The mm-hmm. photo period tells the bird what time of year it is. They match that up with an internal clock, and this gives them their cues in which to migrate. And migration is a very, very interesting topic that I've spent many years studying.
Well, it's amazing that the orioles are here and the hummingbirds almost before the flowers are out.
Well, that's typical. They usually show up. Actually, if you ask me, I think they're running a few days late this year, usually about the 1st of May they show up. And they're going to make a living on a variety of different things. There are some flowers available right now. But really, in particular, hummingbirds don't eat just nectar. They eat insects also. And so as long as the temperatures are warm enough to have some insects around, they are insect eaters. They could not make it just on sugar water. Just not possible. They need protein.
Well, it's amazing also how quickly some of the birds set up housekeeping in the spring. We've still got snow on our ski hill here, Rib Mountain.
Yep.
And yet I saw a pair of Canada geese swimming with seven little goslings yesterday.
Well, look, in nature, it's all about reproduction. Okay, there's really two main driving forces in nature. One of them's food, the other one's reproduction. Those two factors are just immense, and they get down to nesting right away. The birds that return to their territories first, get on the best territories, are the ones who breed first, who produce the most, and these are the genes that are passed on and to produce more in the future. And so it's very, very important for these birds. And there's many species who will have two broods in the year, not the Canada geese, but there's many who will have two broods in the year, like bluebirds, for example. Mm-hmm. They'll come back and they'll have two and sometimes three broods in one year. And so the more, the sooner they get started, the sooner they get to reproduce, and the sooner they're going to be better off.
Have the loons all returned to their home lakes?
They are returning, those birds are literally right on the heels of the ice out on the lakes. As the ice goes out, these birds are literally like right behind it, and they will actually during the daytime fly up, explore lakes, looking for ice out, and then return back to the lakes that are open as they wait, as they move forward. and they're right on the edge of that ice out time. It always amazes me every year. You know, it could be just like 2 days after the ice goes out, bang, the loons are back.
Now you can tell a lot about how a loon is feeling by what the call sounds like. Let me play you a call of a loon that was recorded. This isn't one of yours, maybe you could play bird psychologist and tell us
sure.
what the loon is experiencing here.
Sure.
That one sound, it sounded like it was upset.
What it's doing is actually calling to its mate to come back. That's the call that says, we're too far apart, get back over here. We need to be closer together. I sense something going on. That's the call that calls the mate back to each other. And it's actually used for their children, too.
Well, I'll tell you, the sound of a loon is like nothing else,
yeah.
And it really does epitomize the North Woods. You've got a CD out of loon calls.
Yeah, I have a book called Fascinating Loons and an accompanying CD also that I spent about, I've been photographing loons for over 20 years, but I really spent about 3 years focusing in on specific images for that book and making the audio recordings. And which was actually very convenient because during the day I would get the pictures, and then at night is when they are most vocal. And so when I couldn't take the pictures is when I was doing the audio recordings. And that was a very pleasurable. Of course, it meant for very short nights, but
right.
I was able to shoot during the day, record at night. It was just a wonderful 3 years spent just traveling around and spending all this immense amount of time with these loons.
So you've got a whole CD full of loon calls?
Yeah.
So depending on what mood you're in, you can, I guess, get as loony as you want.
Exactly. But, you know, it's something that if it's heard too much, you know, it's like too much of a good thing, it's not good. This is, I have a audio production company with my brother who, we produce these CDs, and he's mixed this thing up so that it sounds so soothing and so relaxing that it could be something that we should have a warning label on it says, you know, do not operate heavy machinery while listening to this thing because it'll just relax you into a sense of complacency, you know.
Stan Tequila, he's a wildlife photographer, a field guide. He also records the sound of birds, and he's got a website, naturesmart.com. I'm Glenn Moberg. You're listening to Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. If you've got any bird watching questions, if you've got questions about where to go to see the variety of birds that you can see in Wisconsin or the upper Midwest, give us a phone call. We've got about 15 minutes left of the show, 261-6371, 261-6371, or 1-800-780-9742. That's 780-9742. We'll be back after this.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from UMR, providing Employee Benefits Administration, Integrated Health Management, and Pharmacy Benefits Administration for self-funded employers throughout the U.S. More about UMR at umr.com.
Our guest, Stan Tequila, a naturalist and a guy who's made his entire career out of bird watching. He's published over 100 field guides. And if you've got any questions about the birds showing up at your backyard feeder or the behavior of the waterfowl, the cranes that are coming back to Wisconsin this time of the year, give us a call at 261-6371, 261-6371, or 1-800-780-9742. Stan, a couple of years ago, I was able to hang out at the Buena Vista Grasslands in central Wisconsin.
Yep.
We have the Prairie Chicken Festival every year. And I'm going to play a sound of the prairie chickens. They're on the booming grounds right now. And the sound is just unlike anything you've heard before if you haven't heard it.
My favorite part is when they go whoop.
that sound that I recorded inside the blind.
Yeah.
And we were what you're hearing there is a couple of male birds preening and dancing and slashing at each other with their extended legs doing somersaults, doing acrobatics, all in order to impress. There are about a dozen very disinterested females, and the males left very frustrated at the end of the morning.
Oh, my gosh. This has been a great spring. I have concentrated on all the grouse species. I remember I mentioned that I was doing rough grouse this morning. That's culminating this year of photographing and recording both the greater prairie chicken, which you just played, sharp-tailed grouse, and also the rough grouse. But those greater prairie chickens, you're right, the males gather on a communal dancing ground.
The booming ground.
Lek. Yeah, it's called a lek, L-E-K. And all the males gather up together, and then they all display. They lean forward, they inflate these big air sacs on the sides of their necks, they fan their tail up in the air, they droop their wings down, and they give this little display. Now, the females come from far and wide, and they watch, and they look, and they decide which male is dancing the best for them. And they will simply approach that male. And mating doesn't often take place right there on the lek. It does sometimes, but not very often. More times than not, the two of them fly off together. They will have a brief encounter with each other. She'll go off on her own, and then he'll go back to the lek and continue to dance. And all the males get together at one communal place and do this. These sites, these leks are historic, too, in that they use them year after year after year. And there's some of them that have been used for generations and generations. And it's really kind of a neat thing to see. If you ever get a chance to see it, it's well worth it.
People, all of you who are listening, if you've never taken the time to see the prairie chickens do their thing, and if you have a chance, you have to get up at 3 in the morning.
Oh, yeah.
But it is worth it.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the phones right now, 261-6371 or 1-800-780-9742. If you want to talk to Stan Tequila, we have Therese in Lac de Flambeau. Therese, you're on Route 51.
Hi.
Hello.
I have a question. We're in on a lake in Lac de Flambeau area. And I'm from the Madison area, and we have Canada geese down there that drive us crazy. And this is the first year that there's ever been a pair of Canada geese on our lake, and I'm wondering if they will conflict at all with the loons.
No, they won't conflict with the loons. They don't compete for the same food sources. But I'll tell you what, loons are very large birds. They can be very aggressive birds. And all you have to do is go to my website, naturesmart.com, look at my newspaper column, search back a year or two or three, I can't remember now, and I've got a story that I wrote and pictures of a loon killing a western grebe. A western grebe is a bird that kind of does the same thing that the loon does, and it's not well documented, but the loons can be very, very aggressive, very territorial, and they can hold their own, and they're very big birds. I wouldn't worry about them at all. They'd kick the butt on a Canada goose any day. So.
Okay, well.
Don't worry about them.
Thank you.
You bet.
Therese, thanks for the phone call.
Bye-bye.
Stan, let me play another sound for you. This is something else I recorded at the Buena Vista Grasslands. We went on a little bird-watching tour after we watched the prairie chickens. This is a sound of a snipe or a pair of snipes.
Oh, I love this. This is one of my favorite sounds.
And what they told me is these birds aren't making that sound with their vocal cords.
Oh, they're not, yep. They're making it with their tail feathers. Yeah, this is interesting. First of all, yes, there is a bird called a snipe, because I know everybody talks about the snipe hunt, you know, and how it's kind of like a big, wild goose chase. But there is such a bird called a snipe. It's an upland shore bird, meaning it has long legs, but it doesn't really go to the shore. It's in the upland areas. And the males will display over prairie areas in the spring. And I've been out a lot recently, and I've been listening to this. It is one of my all-time favorite sounds. They're high up, a couple hundred feet in the air, and the males will fly in circles, and then they'll make that winnowing noise through rushing air through their tail feathers and their wing feathers. And this is how they're displaying for the females. And you know you're in a wild prairie area when you hear that overhead. And you know you're in a prairie area in the springtime when you hear a snipe. I just love that sound.
Well, Stan, we've been focusing on some of the more colorful and interesting, or some of the rarer birds. Let's talk about some of our common backyard denizens, birds that don't get a lot of respect.
Oh yeah.
Let's talk about starlings.
Oh, the European starling.
Yeah.
One of my favorite birds, because it is a mimic. It can mimic just about any other bird. In fact, it does. If a starling grows up near a blue jay, it'll sound like a blue jay. If it grows up near a bald eagle, it'll sound like a bald eagle. It mimics just about anything it hears, and that for alone is something that I really, really enjoy. I'm not sure, you know, the bird gets a bad rap because it competes for nest cavities with other birds, but you know what? There's a lot of birds that compete for these nest cavities, and I'm not sure that that's really a bad thing. I mean, competition is always a good thing in the natural world.
And what I heard about starlings is they were introduced in New York by a bunch of thespians who wanted to introduce the bird that appears in all of Shakespeare's plays, and they set a few of them loose in Central Park, and now they're everywhere in the United States.
Yeah, there was a Society for the Preservation of Shakespearean Poems, and the society was bent on and actually bringing just about all the animals and birds mentioned in a Shakespearean poem to America. Of course, it only went as far as the starling, but so these birds were actively imported, let go in cities, and now they're all over the place. That, by the way, was over 100 years ago that happened. Obviously, we've had this bird for 100 years. It's done well to fit in. I always argue that, hey, my grandparents came here in 1908 and 1909. Last I checked, I was an American. You know, just how long do these birds have to be here before we're going to consider them part of the family?
Another bird that doesn't get much respect is the crow.
Oh, my gosh, I love the crow.
And maybe it should get respect because, as you were telling us at an appearance you had here in Wausau, they are very intelligent creatures.
Yeah, by far the most intelligent bird we have in North America is the crow and the raven. These birds I admired greatly. I do have this theory, though, that the smarter a bird is, the more people don't like it, and I'm not sure why that is, but I personally love crows. I've been involved in a lot of rehab of crows in the past, and I just admire how smart they are. And if you remember in that talk, I showed that the crows have the ability to use tools. They have the ability to do problem solving.
And we were told that that was something only human beings could do.
Yeah, there was a time when we considered problem solving and using tools as something only humans did. And it was really one of the demarcations between the animal world and the human world. And that has kind of been blown away. Jane Goodall, of course, was our first person who showed us that her chimpanzees were using tools. And since then, we've discovered all sorts of animals and birds using tools.
But the crows actually were bending wire into a certain shape, if I remember, and they were teaching other crows how to do it.
Yeah, what's so great about it is they had this about a 15-inch tall tube, clear tube, about 3 inches in diameter. And then they had like a little Easter egg basket with a little handle on it, and they would fill up that basket with food, and they would drop it to the bottom of that this 15-inch long tube, and then they would introduce the wire to that crow. The crow would poke at the food down at the bottom of the tube, but couldn't get it out until it went and took the wire, bent a little hook on the end of it, reached down, hooked the handle on the basket, pulled it out of the tube, and was able to get to the food. Once it figured it out, it only took them about an hour to figure it out. Once it figured it out, it was able to reproduce that time and time and time again, and then went on to teach other crows how to do it also.
And that's amazing that it was teaching other crows.
Yeah, they do. They have a highly complex communication skills. They have a very high social structure in their families.
Crows are amazing. Hey, Stan, I want to get one more phone call in here, even though we're down to the last couple of minutes. Let's go to Carrie in Ogama. Carrie, you're on Route 51. Thanks for calling back.
Hi, Stan. I've got several of your books, and I very much enjoy them, and I was calling to see what kind of resources you could recommend for finding out more information about sandhill cranes. We have a pair on our lake, and I just kind of like to know more about, like, their life expectancy, how long their young stay with them, and so forth.
All right, very quickly, Stan, you've got less than a minute.
Well, the sandhill cranes are actually very long-lived birds, and in the wild, they can live up to 20 years or so. They are the young will stay with their parents through the first winter, but by next spring they'll be dispersed and the parents will go off on their own to reproduce. So.
And where can Carrie go to find out more about
them? There are actually several very nice books about sandhill cranes out there, and you shouldn't have any problems finding anything on the internet too for that. It's such a well-known species that you shouldn't have any problems finding any information on it. So,
Carrie, thanks so much for the call.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling back. And Stan Tequila, we are out of time.
Oh, darn.
I really enjoyed this.
Absolutely, me too.
We want to thank today's guest, Stan Tequila, and remind you that you can all check out his wildlife guides, including Birds of Wisconsin, Mammals of Wisconsin, and Wildflowers of Wisconsin, and his CDs of bird calls and his wildlife photography at naturesmart.com. I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, our on-air producer, Kelson Quisler. Thanks, as always, to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Next Thursday on Route 51, we look at the serious water quality issues facing a major central Wisconsin aquifer, the Big Eau Plaine Reservoir, which suffered a fish kill over the winter, estimated at up to 75% of the total population. Now, next week, we've got all sites covered for you. You'll hear from the DNR, from Wisconsin Valley Improvement, from the Marathon County Planning Department, and from the leaders of a citizens group of homeowners and local businesses trying to see that this past year's fish kill will be the last. Thanks again for riding with us today. We're out of time. Until next week, we are heading out of town.